core of what's going wrong in mental health challenges is not what's happening inside someone's body or brain that you can then like tweak or modify with medication, but it's the larger world of relationships and communities and cultures. And
welcome back to season 3 of Intrinsically Motivated, where we have conversations with experts in the field of addiction, recovery, and those personally affected by it as we seek to mobilize the church to replace addiction and mental health challenges with flourishing. On today's episode, we'll be sitting down with Warren Kinghorn. He is a psychiatrist and theological ethicist with a joint faculty appointment in the Medical and Divinity School at Duke University. Warren also works as a staff psychiatrist at the Durham VA Medical Center.
I guess, how did you find your way into this kind of work? What was the path that kind of led you here? What was it that kind of drew you here to begin with?
Yeah, I found myself in medical school straight out of college, quite young, and as a Christian who'd been in church my whole life, but had never had any formal theological training. And I was a first and second year student at Harvard Medical School in Boston. And the medical area of Boston was larger, a denser urban area than the city where I'd grown up in South Carolina. And I found myself wondering, what is all this for? And we had this really dynamic Christian community in the medical school, and specifically a mentor, Bill Pearson, who kept asking me, like, how do you understand what all of this is for? Like, why do people invest in the world of medicine and healthcare? And I began to realize that there were questions that I was learning to answer as a medical student, like the how of how the body works and how the medical system works. But I wasn't being encouraged, at least in an explicit way, to answer the big questions, like, what does it mean to be healthy? You know, what does it mean to think of our bodies as finite and mortal? What does it mean to approach suffering? How do we think about dying well or living well? And to me, those were broader questions that the medical system tries to answer a little bit, but can't really do so. But I was a Christian. I wanted to understand the tradition that I had grown up in. So I left medical school for a couple of years, came here to Duke to study theology. It changed my life because it helped me to understand that while as a physician, I was inhabiting this world of biomedicine that was maybe 100, 200 years old. As a Christian, I was inhabiting this tradition that was 2,000 plus years old of people reflecting on what it means to be human. So that got me interested in psychiatry. Again, it got me interested in, it led me to see the beauty of clinical practice and medicine. And it really led me to care about the work of the church as it regards to healthcare. So I came back to Duke. I did my residency in psychiatry. And now for the last 15 years, I've had the privilege of teaching both in the medical school and also the Divinity School at Duke. And that's led me to continue interest in thinking about how do Christians think specifically about mental health challenges, about the way that diagnosis works in mental health and mental illness, about the way that we care for people and walk alongside people.
That's and I'm curious, just because I know you said you grew up in South Carolina.
Yeah.
And then you ended up at Harvard. Was there a big culture shock in going from one to the other? It seems like that would be a big difference in just like...
There was. I'd grown up my entire life in upstate South Carolina in Greenville, and I went to college there at Furman. And when I went to Boston, I initially had this sense that I was going to just a completely different place where I was just hoping, honestly, that I could speak the language. And what I found when I got there is that, yes, it was different, although not maybe as different as I had expected, that people were still people.
Yeah.
You know, students were still students, people were still people. And I grew to really love the culture of New England and the city of Boston. And it was really a rich place. And I think also being a Christian there was a little bit different than being a Christian in my college.
Yeah, I was curious about that because I know that like my initial thought is, oh, you're up in one of those big cities, they're going to be so irreligious. And you said you had a Christian community while you were there.
I had an amazing Christian community, but it was in some ways my like first close encounter with the global church. I'd grown up in South Carolina, surrounded mostly by Southern evangelical Protestant Christians. That was really powerful and important, and that was good. And when I went to Boston, our medical student Christian organization was, there was a few of us who were from the U.S. and from the South, but there was also, you know, a colleague who was a Coptic Christian of Egyptian descent. There was a fellow student who was a Nigerian Pentecostal. There were folks from all over the world, from East Asia, from Africa, from South America, who were united in this desire to, what does it mean to follow Jesus in a really complex world of academic medicine. And so we learned from each other. I learned from them. And it was just a really powerful experience to have that sense of connection with others. And it wasn't normative to be a Christian at Harvard Medical School.
Right.
But neither was it the kind of thing that I felt alone. I always felt like there were other people around me, and there were really important places of support and encouragement. So it was a really powerful
time. Yeah, and I think just, you know, you talk about there being this kind of diversity of background and people around. It's like, if it is a, like you said, it's not normative. Like, it's a small, like here, down in the South, you can pick and choose what kind of place you want to worship. You can find any flavor of Christianity that you want. But when it is a little bit more limited, it really is amazing to see how the church is still able to kind of come together and find that kind of common community. And it's like, there's no reason, like, if you were trying to find that really traditional, maybe Southern approach to evangelical Christianity, it might have been harder to find a large community for that. But at the same time, it's like, we're all still believing the same things, and we're able to kind of...
And I was part of a great church, and I mean, there are a lot of faithful Christians in Boston and all over. And so it was finding them and that kind of encouragement that I'm never alone. One story that I'll tell, since I've written about this publicly, is when I was a second year medical student, our Christian organization sponsored a talk in the medical school that was a medical missionary couple who was working in a free health clinic in an impoverished area of Philadelphia, and we had connections with them. We invited them up. We advertised the talk as something like "Care for the Underserved in West Philadelphia." And this couple got up and gave their talk, and in the midst of their talk, most of it was just about the challenges of serving in an urban area where a lot of people were marginalized and there weren't many services. But in the middle of the talk, one of the couple said, people ask why we do this. We do this because we believe that every human being is created in the image of God, and we believe that the Holy Spirit has called us to do this work. And then she went on with her talk. And it turned out that some students in the room felt kind of blindsided by that because they hadn't realized that it was going to be a talk by Christians.
Right.
And the campus advisor, Bill Pearson, who I mentioned, actually was working at the time as an anatomy instructor in the anatomy lab, and he was called in by a medical school administrator and told not only that he would lose his job in the anatomy lab or that his position wouldn't be renewed, but that he wasn't welcome to come on campus anymore. So he had moved with his family into Boston specifically to minister to medical students, and he was basically expelled from the Harvard Medical School campus. And that was a crisis moment.
Yeah.
And he had to decide how to respond, and the community had to decide how to respond. But Bill stayed with his family. He didn't come on campus, but he did continue to meet with us off campus. He continued to be a really powerful support in community. And a year went by. And a year later, that same administrator called Bill into his office and said, I just want you to know that I've been thinking about what happened last year, and I acted too harshly, that in retrospect, I don't think that was an appropriate action on my part, and you're welcome to come back onto campus. And had Bill left Boston at that point, I think that our community would have been profoundly different.
Right.
But Bill and his family stayed. And not only did they stay, but the seeds of that community became this really amazing intentional Christian community that still exists in Boston called the Longwood Christian Community.
That's amazing.
And there are people now that are writing and speaking nationally about faith and medicine, like Lydia Dugdale and Tyler Vanderweil, and especially Michael and Tracy Balboni, who are the two founders of that community, who are continuing to do that work. And it came out of that same circle of connection and relationship of Christians at Harvard saying, we want to be connected to each other, and we believe that the gospel matters for what we're doing in healthcare, and this is profoundly important work.
And being led by that mentality of, yes, we're facing some challenges right now, but we're going to stick it out, too, even as we kind of face that adversity or whatever that challenge may be, too.
I think there's something about staying when things are hard and learning to love a place and its people over a long period of time. I saw that demonstrated with Bill and his family. He didn't stay in Boston forever. He's now living elsewhere and teaching elsewhere. But at that time, it was really powerful. It was a powerful witness to me that he and his family stayed.
He was willing to stick it out, yeah.
Yeah, and it was hard, and I think there was also just tremendous fruit that came from that.
Yeah, that's amazing. Obviously, lots of training. You ended up here. Mm-hmm. and I already got you to read me your bio and tell me all of your titles. And there's lots of things in there. Yeah. But what do you think of yourself as?
Great question. I think of myself as a clinician. This afternoon, I will be in a clinic room in the basement of the VA hospital, seeing veterans who come to me for care. And they don't come to me because I'm a Christian or because I'm a professor. They just come to me because I'm their psychiatrist. And that's really important to me to care well for them. I think of myself as a teacher. So I've had the opportunity for the last 15 years, especially here at the Divinity School, but also in the medical center, to be involved in forming generations now of clinicians who come through Duke for training, and that's important. And I think of myself as hopefully a physician teacher who is doing work that is of service to the church. I had a really powerful moment when I was finishing my master's degree here at Duke, where a professor pulled me aside, and he knew that I was heading back to medical school and that I wasn't sure what I was going to do with my life. And he said, "Warren, I just want you to I charge you to think of your work, whatever it turns out as in service of the church." And that's always something that I've taken seriously. So it's something that I aspire to, whether that's the case or not is up to others to judge, but it's something I aspire to.
We talked about this at CMR earlier this year, the Conference on Medicine and Religion. If I probably should give some context to that. Yeah. But we talked, because we went and sat at your book table to talk about your Wayfaring book. Yeah. And it seems like you're kind of blending a lot of those things together and what you're talking about in that, and that you want to kind of help reshape, is reshape the right word, or just kind of rethink the way that medical practitioners kind of apply their Christianity into their practice and the way they treat their patients? What was kind of your motivation behind writing that book?
Well, I love the work of, I love being a psychiatrist. I love the work of psychiatry. I love practicing in a pluralistic health system like the VA and the Department of Psychiatry at Duke. And I think that there are ways in that the institutional practices of psychiatry can, I think, cause us to lose sight of what's most important. There's tremendous pressure these days in every health system to focus on efficiency and productivity. And one way to kind of summarize some of what I do in the book is to think about what I call the machine metaphor of mental health care. And it kind of boils down to this, that if you wanted to design a mental health care system along the lines of an industrial process, how might you do it? So one way that you might do it is how I think I was in some ways formed, which is to be trained for people to come into my office, as they will this afternoon, and with complex human experiences. They're feeling ways they don't want to feel. They're thinking in ways they don't want to think. They're acting in ways they don't want to act. And I can say, oh, now I recognize what's happening with you. You're having symptoms, which is a way of renaming their experience. So I'm saying, well, you have a symptom of loss of energy or loss of interest in pleasurable activity, or you're hearing voices, or you're using alcohol when you don't want to, and that's not what your goal is. And then I'm trained to cluster those symptoms together into diagnoses. So based on that, I can diagnose someone with major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder or alcohol use disorder. And then I can reach into my toolbox of evidence-based treatments and medications, and I can say, well, take this medication. This can help with your symptoms. Let me refer you to this therapy that can be helpful for your symptoms. And then I hope that those treatments will reduce the patient's symptoms and that they'll come back to me in, you know, a week or 2 weeks or 4 weeks later, and they'll say, I feel much better. And I'll say, great, like your symptoms are reduced and therefore the treatment's working, and so let's keep going. So it's so easy to think of mental health care, especially in psychiatry, as like this technical process of symptom reduction. And we do that from a number of ways. But if you want, pretty much every clinical trial in psychiatry involves like quantifying people's experience on a scale, and then you try to see if the rating of their symptoms has changed from before the treatment to after the treatment. And if something differs from placebo and is effective and changed, then we call that an evidence-based treatment. And that's what we do in psychiatry. We apply practices and techniques to try to reduce symptoms. And there's a lot of good in that. Like, I want my patients to have fewer symptoms and to be in less distress. But I also don't want to lose sight of bigger questions. So one huge question that is lacking if we think of mental health care as only about symptom reduction is, like, how do people relate to the world around them? We can lose sight of the fact that sometimes what's the core of what's going wrong in mental health challenges is not what's happening inside someone's body or brain that you can then like tweak or modify with the medication, but it's the larger world of relationships and communities and cultures and economic opportunities and other things to which people are responding.
Right. Yeah.
And if we only focus on symptoms, we're not ever going to get to those
things. Yeah. That's one of the things that we talk about. We do a lot of trauma-informed care training and these sorts of things. And it's, we're looking at all of these experiences are building up to these responses. And there are going to be, you know, some physical things that have changed in responses, but a lot of those things are still building off of everything that's come before that, that's building up to that moment.
That's right. And it all happens. We're bodies. I mean, we are embodied souls. We live in this world and in this life as bodies. And so like when we're exposed to traumatic experiences, when we're exposed to ongoing stress, when there's challenges in our relationships, when we don't get the nutrition we need, when we don't have the housing that we need, that shows up in our bodies and brains. So everything that happens in our life happens in our bodies. And yet it doesn't necessarily start with our bodies as if the only problem is our bodies or our brains. It might be that the core of the problem is the broader challenges in the world in which we live.
Right.
And so we have to just acknowledge that, you know?
And I think a lot of times we're kind of trained to only think in if there is a medicine that I can take to make that symptom go away, that's the preferred thing for me, and not even addressing whatever the bigger societal things are in my life sometimes. It's like, well, no, just give me the medicine and I'll be...
Right.
Because I think it seems we can wrap our brains around that. We can kind of wrap our minds around, I understand I have a headache, I take an ibuprofen, and all of a sudden I feel better. Yeah. But rather, what was it in my life that led to that? Oh, maybe it was I didn't drink that cup of coffee. Oh, well, maybe that means I drink too many cups of coffee, or, you know, whatever it may be. And there's other reasons that led to that. And I think we try to think, oh, well, I'll just take the ibuprofen and that'll fix it. And it does, but it's not everything.
Yeah. And to be clear, I'm not against medication.
Right.
Medication is profoundly helpful for a lot of people. And especially when people are really struggling and suffering, when they're having trouble getting out of bed, when they're having trouble like beginning to do the work of engaging in community or going to therapy, when the people are having persistent thoughts of suicide, mm-hmm. when people are experiencing psychotic experiences, medications are absolutely helpful. And,
yes.
and I would recommend. And medications are very rarely the sole solution to getting somebody where they want to go. I use the image of the starting line and the finish line a lot of times with my patients. So I say, you know, medication, like if you think of the finish line as where you want to be in your life, like your relationships are going well, you know, you're feeling good, you're doing what you want to do, you're happy. Like it's unlikely that any medication that I prescribe is going to get you to that finish line by its own activity. But the medication can help you get to the starting line,
right?
Where you can then begin to do the kind of work.
This is the exact kind of conversation that we find ourselves in, especially when we're talking about addiction and recovery. A lot of times, is because there are a lot of treatment right now is medication focused for addiction, and a lot of people think that we're just trying to say, well, we think, you know, medication assisted treatment's absolutely unhelpful and we should get rid of it entirely, which is not it.
Yeah.
But I've talked to lots of people who have been prescribed a particular medication and then been told, congratulations, you're now in recovery.
Yeah.
And then they've said, that's funny, I don't feel like I'm in recovery yet. I feel like I'm still in the same cycle of life that I have been, just with a different substance that maybe less harmful to me in the long run, but I still feel like I'm kind of in the same place. But like you said, it is a great starting line. You're not going to overdose. You're not going to die as easily on this medication. But now you might have a little bit more space in your life to begin working on the other areas that maybe can help you get all the way to that finish line. And I do think that is a conversation. That's more the conversation we've been trying to have is, what if we don't... I love the start line, finish line. What if we see this as a starting point?
Yeah.
And we talk about trying to live a life of flourishing. Does it look like... Do you feel like your life is flourishing yet? Is there something more that we could hope for, or are we just going to be satisfied with getting to the starting line?
Yeah.
And so I love that analogy.
Yeah. I don't want to contradict anyone's experience, because what you say is very powerful. In the case of medications for opioid use disorder, alcohol use disorder, I mean, it is true that someone might say, well, I was using heroin or I was using prescription opioids, and now I'm on methadone or Suboxone, and I'm still feel like I'm taking something every day, and I'm still in some ways dependent on it. On a physiological level, that has truth to it, mm-hmm. Because I think the methadone and Suboxone is doing things that are helping to kind of replace the opioid receptors craving for the substance. And yet we know in general that people who are on methadone and people who are on Suboxone have so much more freedom from those cycles of addictive behavior to be able to do other things in their life that they care for. So I think that's a great example of like, you know, methadone alone isn't going to get you to the finish line. Suboxone alone is not going to get you to the finish line, but it can get you to the starting line where you can do really profoundly important work. And then figure out over time what that means for the doses that you need to be in kind of maintenance treatment.
Yeah.
Same with naltrexone for alcohol use disorder, for example. Yeah.
So I want to ask you a little bit of a techie question about how some of those things work in our brains. And if this is not in your area of expertise, you don't have to answer it.
Sure.
But this is just the kind of thing that we've been looking at in some of our research and things that we've been talking about specific to opioid use and then medication for opioid use disorder, that sort of thing, in that, you know, our brains naturally produce opioids when we connect with people and endorphins and these sorts of things. And then we kind of replace that ability to connect with people when we start introducing these kind of exogenous opioids and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The medication that we take to keep us from overdosing and again, freeing up parts of our lives with Suboxone or methadone or things like that are still connecting to those parts of our brain. Mm-hmm. Do you think, and again, you may not have anything to say specifically to this, but I'm just curious, do you, from your perspective, do you think that's inhibiting the part of our brain that allows us to desire to connect with other people and find community? Because one of the things that we're looking at is, can we get such intense interpersonal connection in people's lives that we can kind of get your brain kind of reset, I guess is kind of a way to say it, retrained to begin producing those natural occurring, you know, those endogenous opioids all on its own. And I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on how that might would work, or if some of the things that we're introducing exogenously can inhibit our ability or our desire to connect with other people.
Well, I'm not a neuroscientist, so I want to be clear about that.
Right.
There's others who can speak more to the basic neuroscience. I am a clinician, so I think about this from a clinical perspective. Mm-hmm. And I would say that that we know, and by we, I mean, you know, the communities of clinicians over time who've come alongside people with substance use problems, know that on average, and looking at a population, that when people are unable to control and regulate their use of opioids, that having someone either take methadone or to be inducted into buprenorphine and to be on Suboxone can meaningfully make a difference in their ability to disrupt those cycles of abuse and dependence and to do other meaningful things in their lives going forward. And eventually to perhaps wean off of the Suboxone and the methadone. But I think that takes time. I think it is true that, you know, our bodies make opioids, our bodies make oxytocin, these kinds of hormones and neurotransmitters and chemicals that we need. And that part of the way addiction works is to like basically flood the brain with these external chemicals that kind of trick our brain into thinking, oh, everything's great now.
We're doing great, yeah.
You know, but it's just because I've just used a dose of opioids that, that you know, but my brain is thinking everything's great, and therefore we can continue to kind of impart through the cycles of tolerance and withdrawal. We continue to kind of need to have that experience that everything's great, and that's what leads to cycles of addiction. Now, you know, do things like exercise and social connection and meaningful activity help us to create endogenous opioids that can help to replace that? Yes, that's the case. But if that were the solution, then people would have figured out long before they come into treatment, because they could just say, well, okay, I'm using too many opioids, so I'm going to go run or exercise to be around other people. The clinical reality is that sometimes those patterns are just too strong. People find themselves in cycles that they can't voluntarily break out of without a lot of help. And so the medications can help with that. As a transition, you know, I don't ever want to say that someone, because they start taking, you know, methadone or Suboxone when they're, you know, 25 years old, would have to be on it when they're 75 years old. But I think that's something to make judgments about over time as someone's life goes on, and then to work on reducing doses, to maybe transition from methadone to Suboxone, for example, to maybe eventually then go to something else. There's lots of options that clinicians can draw from.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think the thing that we're concerned in finding out is, can we over, I know you said nobody, it might be that they're so I guess, trapped in the throes of addiction. They find themselves in such a spiraling kind of downward place that they're going to need something else to kind of help them break out of that cycle. Yeah. And I think one of the things we're wanting to find out is, knowing that they may not naturally want that, but if we could replace that with Christian community, right, or connection to their creator, that sort of thing, over if somebody exogenously introducing that level of community in the same way that we would introduce Suboxone, methadone, those sorts of things. And that's kind of what we're wanting to see, if that can be effective and be a lasting life of flourishing opportunity for people as well. And so,
well, I would see that not as an either or, but as a both and.
Okay. So, yeah. And like I said, we're not trying to say we want to throw out medication as an option. I think that sometimes gets assumed of us just because we're talking about medication alternatives. But I think we're trying to see how can we introduce, we want to see what human connection can be beyond just that starting line that you were talking about earlier.
Well, the core distinction that I try to make in the book Wayfaring is a distinction between thinking of human beings as machines that need to be fixed. And if we think of the person experiencing addiction as a machine that needs to be fixed, then we immediately turn to things like, oh, they just need, you know, buprenorphine to, you know, partially, you know, latch onto their opioid receptors and think things are going to be good. Or they just need methadone to replace the opioids in their system. And we think of it as a physiological problem.
Right.
But that's not a Christian way to think about human beings, because human beings aren't machines. And we don't need fixing primarily. I think the distinction is that we're not machines that need to be fixed, but we're wayfarers who need to be attended. We are creatures of God who come from God, who are on our way to God, and we find ourselves in this life on a journey. And so the key question for any clinician or any pastor or any friend is not to come alongside somebody and say, hey, like, how are they broken and need to be fixed? But rather, what's needed right now for the journey that this person is on? And if someone is deep in cycles of opioid or alcohol or cocaine or pornography, whatever the use is that they've lost control over and that's causing damage in their life, then the broad question is, what's needed right now for the journey? And always, I think without exception, always the answer is community. You know, addiction is inherently isolating. People find themselves isolating themselves from their community, from their family. They often are ostracized in different ways. They've often done things that are really painful to themselves and to others. So reintroduction to community is always critical. It's always the answer, healthy community.
Right.
And then what else is needed? So, you know, in addition to community, might someone benefit from medications? And often the answer is yes.
Yeah. And I love that in coming back to community, because I think of, like, even where we started, where you're talking about, you found this really deep community when you were in school and all of these things, even as you go through particularly difficult times, maybe somebody loses their position at a school and they stay because they think that community is still valuable in these sorts of things. And I think where we work a lot in Appalachia, and this is a thing that one of our other collaborators has been studying, is like the community within small towns and little areas of central Appalachia are so important to who the people are. It's just, this whole town is my family, or this whole town, or these are the same, we've been here for 10 generations or whatever it may be. And I know you all here at Duke have been kind of partnering with and studying different parts of, you know, central Appalachia where we are, and that's how we ended up connecting and collaborating originally. What was it that originally kind of drew you all over to connect with Central Appalachia and kind of see what all was going on over there?
Yeah, well, the primary connection came through a series of relationships with folks who live in the Tri-Cities area who had studied here at Duke and who I think were just passionate about the kind of rich community that exists in the Tri-Cities and also aware of some of the needs, especially at that point. This was when the opioid crisis was kind of sweeping in waves over all of Appalachia, all of the United States, but concentrated in places like Appalachia. And so my colleague Brett McCarty, who is a qualitative researcher and theologian who really cares about how the church can help serve the needs of communities in ways that both help serve health needs but also draw people closer to Jesus, began to just have more conversations. And that, I'm so grateful that led to connection with you all and to the whole network of people are doing just amazing work in Southwest Virginia, in East Tennessee, all those areas.
Yeah. One thing I want to go back to, just because you've said it a couple of times, I've been thinking about this a lot, is just this idea of embodied souls.
Yeah.
So if we could, I would, because that is a new, it's not a new concept, but it's a new concept that I now have a label for me.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't realize that was the idea that I've been talking about. And I've heard you say it a couple of times. And I know when we were talking about, while we were setting up all the microphones, I said the phrase embodied souls, and you lit up and you smiled and all these sorts of things.
Absolutely.
What is it about this idea of us both being like soul and body created by God, and both of these things being valuable? How is that? So we were talking about who our audience is for this podcast. And a lot of people that listen to this, I think, are churchgoers who are interested in figuring out ways that they can serve the people in their lives. Yeah. Some of them, a lot of them struggling with addiction, all of them experiencing some sort of trauma or adversity, I would imagine, in some form or another. And so I think this idea of being able to see us as physical beings that have a soul that can connect to God is, I think, really important. And I just would love to hear you talk a little bit about, for you, what that means and how that helps maybe influence the way that you serve people as a clinician or just as a Christian.
Yeah, it's really important because it comes to the question of how did God make us, and what does it mean to be a creature? The Kentucky agrarian writer and essayist Wendell Berry talks about this in relationship to Genesis 2:7. I think Genesis 2 is a really critical passage here. Genesis 2:7, the Lord God formed the man from the dust of the earth, and into his body he breathed the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And Barry, when he talks about that verse, he says, and I'll paraphrase, not quote directly, but he says that most people think that the formula for, in Barry's words, man-making is human equals body plus soul. But he said that's not what Genesis 2:7 says. The formula for man-making in Genesis 2:7 is soul equals dust plus breath. Because the Hebrew word for living being in Genesis 2:7 is nephesh, which would be not just a body, like an inanimate body, not just an immaterial soul, but a living being, like a body who's living and moving just as you are now and I am now. And so that holistic concept of soul is still existence. And one might say, like, I went into a room expecting to find somebody and there wasn't a soul there. Like, it's ways in which, like, the soul is not like something separate from the body, but it sort of is the whole embodied person. And that's the Hebrew concept of personhood that involves more than just like the cells and proteins of our body, but it starts with our body. Like, we are embodied persons. Now, Christians have had a lot of ways of reflecting on that over the years, and early Christians were affected by the larger like Greco-Roman thought around them, especially from Plato, that tended to see our bodies as in some ways like, you know, shells or things that we would kind of escape from, you know. So, you know, the hymn "Sweet Hour of Prayer," you know, this robe of flesh I'll doff and rise to cleave the everlasting skies. This idea of seeing like the body as this kind of robe of flesh, and Paul sometimes talks in ways that can be interpreted this way too. That like our bodies are just kind of epiphenomenal to who we are; they're not core to who we are. But the overall witness of Scripture, including in Paul, is to see that like we are not like essentially these immaterial beings that somehow like leave our bodies behind, as Plato would have held.
Right.
But rather we are whole persons, like whole body souls. So embodied souls and ensouled bodies. And that's who we are. And so when folks like St. Thomas Aquinas, who I draw on a lot in the book Wayfaring, talks about what it means to be human, he's drawing actually not from Plato but from Aristotle, to think of the soul as in some ways the form of the living body, so that we're not to be seen as like stark body soul dualities, but rather as body soul unities. That we are bodies who are thinking, moving, feeling, acting creatures on our way to God, and that's who we are fundamentally.
And just hearing you say it that way is causing me to kind of reflect back on how, going back to Genesis 2 and creation, like we were created to bear the image of God. And it's like we get to kind of demonstrate kind of that oneness in God's Trinitarian nature, even in the way that we're both these things at the same time. It's like there are two aspects, but they're both kind of one in the same way that God is God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit, but he's still one God. I'm going lots of interesting places, and I'm thinking about all this.
This gets us deep into Trinitarian theology. Oh, I know. Into Christology too.
So, I know, yeah, but, it, yeah, but it's like yeah. we don't have time to go off on that tangent. But I'm sitting here thinking of like this is another way in which we get to image God at the creation, which was his whole point, in that we represent him well here on earth in those both of those aspects, because Jesus is both God and he's man and yeah. all of these things. I'm sorry. Now you're laughing at me over. Off mic, president over there, laughing at me.
Well, I think I would just say, without getting into a lot of theological.
No, it's okay. If you go, we'll go. I'll follow you.
I just think that remembering that Christians learned from and are, we owe our understanding of what it means to be faithful to the people of Israel. I mean, Jesus was a Jewish rabbi, and Israel's Messiah, and Jewish thought would never sharply separate body from soul in the way that Plato would. So, like the inheritance, if I hesitate to say that, but the deep lessons of what it means to follow the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is to understand that that God created like specific material creatures. Not only human beings, but other creatures also, and called it good. So there's a goodness to creation, and a goodness to our bodies, and a goodness to the natural world around us, and a goodness to who we are in our flesh and in our bodies that just is a core of what it means to be creatures. And we can so easily slip into again a more. I mean, there's philosophical schools that I could name, but there's a tendency in especially Greek philosophy to see the material as somehow evil, or the material as somehow like not real or epiphenomenal. And so we think of like the core of who we are as immaterial, and that's what's important. But that is just not a Jewish way of understanding the world. It's not how Jesus taught, and it's not how the early church practiced. And I think that becomes important in part because it was Christians who prioritized the care of the sick in the early centuries of the church. So Jesus was a healer. He touched people. He touched people who were on the margins to heal them. And the early Christians followed suit. They would touch people and look at people that were on the margins because they mattered. And early Christians actually invented the institution of the charity hospital, because you had early Christian monasteries in what's now Turkey who believed that they were to welcome the stranger into their community, because Jesus is present in the body of the one who's sick and the one who's ill and the one who's homeless, as Matthew 25 tells us. They began to form infirmaries to provide medical care to people, to, again, touch the bodies of those that were ill, because our bodies are good as creatures. And that directly led to the institution of the modern charity hospital, including the ones that are surrounding us here in North Carolina, including the ones that surround you in Tennessee.
And I'm so glad you said that, because that kind of brings it all back around to what we are trying to get at with the church from our perspective here at Uplift, is like we're trying to motivate the church to still own that part of their identity.
Absolutely.
And it's because it's so easy now, because there are so many other options for care.
Yeah.
That it's easy to let there's another hospital out there, or there's another charity out there, or there's another government program out there. That's not right. Saying that those need to go away, but to say that we are too comfortable in just letting those things take care of that. We'll take care of something. We'll just focus on the soul.
Right.
Or we'll just, focus on, we'll kind of turn ourselves inward and focus on our own kind of spiritual formation. And we kind of are wanting to see the church view people and their well-being physically as part of our mission as well.
Yeah.
Something that the church can kind of begin to reclaim, take that back.
I mean, we're talking on a Monday morning. Yesterday, which was Sunday, I got up in the morning, I, ate breakfast, I got dressed, I went and sat and stood in a room of about 250 other people. We sang together, we shook hands, we hugged, we talked, we received the body of Christ in the form of bread and grape juice. I left the church sanctuary and drank coffee in conversation with people. we gathered around tables to kind of talk about our lives in the week. And then I went home. Now, was that a kind of spiritual work? Well, yes. I mean, we were thinking about our lives in relationship to God, but everything I've just named is a bodily practice, and it changed my own body, you know, not only taking in the body and blood of Christ and the in communion, but just the practice of being physically with other people, of singing right. with other people. Like, we breathed each other's air, you know, which we don't like to think about in a post-pandemic time. We, you know, we were with each other in ways that made a difference for who we are. So I find that my own personhood is in part now constituted by these people who I see at least once a week at church and who are my family. And that profoundly matters for who we are. And we do right. that in the body. We don't do that just as like intellects or, you know, disembodied souls. We do that as bodies, and that's critical.
Don't neglect to meet together as becoming the habit of some.
Yeah, but meet together and eat together is just central to what Christians do.
That's one of my go-tos is Acts 2. They were day by day.
Absolutely.
Eating meals together. And
absolutely.
And I think we can, as the church, if we see that physical act of eating a meal with somebody
yeah.
as a way of actually caring for somebody's soul as well, you know.
Absolutely.
And specifically for me, thinking of people that are, like you said, at the margins, people that are maybe don't have that structure around them, that like they have been kind of left to the side.
Yeah.
If we can pull those people into our communities, that's how we're going to help them find healing too. Yeah.
And I think just recognizing the barriers to that. So, I mean, the reality of shame in both mental health challenges and in addiction, and frankly, in our broader world, is just a profoundly isolating force. So people feel that, you know, I have either done things or I am just not enough to be accepted by a community in which I need to belong. And so the forces of shame creep in. We feel like we're going to be ostracized, and some people have been ostracized. And then that then leads people to distance and to cut off relationships and to not go to church, to not seek out friends, to not invite others to eat. And so you get this, I mean this in a like literal way, this like vicious cycle where, like, you know, isolation begets isolation, where people feel shame, they isolate themselves. That then intensifies suffering, and it makes having the connection and healing resources less accessible. And then people get into a cycle where you're increasingly isolated and also increasingly doing things that are deeply, deeply harmful. And so reversing that cycle, and I think reversing the cycle, it starts with an acknowledgement that you are enough, and we want you here. And we love you regardless of what you've done or who you are or what you're feeling about yourself or, frankly, what others are feeling about you. And that's easy to say.
Right.
But it's hard to do when there's been real hurt, both on the part of the person and the community. And so communities walking through that in healthy ways, in ways that are sometimes messy, but that's the work of the church is to figure out what that looks like on the ground way.
And I'm hoping that as people are hearing this, they're like, that's what we need to be doing, because that's what I feel like we've been crying in the wilderness for, you know, years yeah. saying this is what we need to be doing, is acknowledging that shame or, you know, the stigma, or I mean that's kind of one of those words that people are familiar with. It's like it's there, but it goes both ways too. There's fear yeah. of the church, and there's church fear of other people. Yeah. You know, and that shouldn't be, and we should know better. And I think there are, I'm not saying that it means that that's universally true of the church, but it is definitely true in pockets of the church. Yeah. And it's hard work to kind of overcome that, but I believe it's possible. And I think having a right understanding of who we are and who people are
yeah.
and having, feeling that kind of value that people have,
I think sometimes
is so important.
When people are caught in addiction or mental health challenges, we erect, and I do this too, we erect like barricades around ourselves. We end up in these like heavily fortified bunkers with no door. And what blocks egress from that is shame. And what keeps other people from coming in is stigma.
Yeah.
And so like shame is a sentry on the inside and stigma is a sentry on the outside. And it becomes very hard to break through that. So working on decreasing stigma and decreasing shame, not just because like we should be fighting stigma in general, but because the person inside is
valuable.
Beloved of God yeah. and valuable, and someone for whom Christ died and for whom God's heart yearns and aches, and we want each person to to find life in wholeness. Like, that's why we fight stigma, is because people matter.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's perfect. So last thing, and this is more just me being curious, anything you're working on right now that you're excited about, or anything that's coming, that you're writing right now that you're excited about? I just want to give you the opportunity to talk about things that are exciting to you too, because we've talked about everything that's exciting to me. I want to know what's currently exciting to you.
Well, I'm excited about a lot, but the next bigger project that I'm beginning to work on is specifically thinking about how Christians respond to suicide. I've been really moved in the last year or so by the story of Paul and the Philippian jailer in Acts 16, where, if you remember the story, Paul and his friends are in Philippi for just a few days. They have met Lydia. They've liberated a young woman from basically trafficking, and she had a spirit of divination. For that, they're beaten and flogged, and they're thrown into prison unjustly. They're singing hymns in the night. There's an earthquake. Their chains fall off, and everything about the story would suggest that it's time for them to go. They've been delivered. But they see the jailer drawing his sword and about to kill himself. And Paul shouts in a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." And I think that that response is exactly what people considering suicide need to hear in our time. Both sides of it. Do not harm yourself. So a clear affirmation that your life matters, that you're of value, and specifically that do not harm yourself. I think people need to hear that in multiple ways. And with that, we are all here. There is a community here that loves you and cares for you and wants to support you and can show that. And the jailer did not die. He invited Paul and his friends to his home. He fed them. He washed their wounds. He knelt at Paul's feet and asked, "How might I be saved?" He and his entire family were baptized. And so this man who might have died by suicide that night and have been lost to our memory instead lived. And we don't know what happened to him after that, but I like to think that he became like part of a member of this little fledgling house church of Philippi, along with Lydia and maybe this woman who was delivered from the spirit and these others, and became one of these first Christians in the continent of Europe in Philippi. And I like to think that when Paul wrote his letter to the Philippians years later, and this church that he had only seen for a few days, it's such a loving letter, and he says, "You know, I pray continually for you because you hold me in your heart, because you've not stopped believing from the first day until now." I like to wonder, like, who was present when that letter was read aloud, as it would have been, in the gathered community? And maybe there was a middle-aged man there who remembered that day years ago when he might have died by suicide, but didn't, and lived to another day. So how can Christians in our day, at a time when suicide is just a pressing public health issue and just an immense human tragedy, how can we act constructively to help not only keep people alive, but to give people a reason to stay alive and to live and to build the kind of communities that we need for each other?
Because we're here.
Because we're
here. We're here.
That's right.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for being on here with us. This was very helpful for me. Every time I do one of these conversations, I say I do it selfishly just because I like to have interesting conversations and learn lots. And this was very helpful for me. So
thanks for being here. It's such a pleasure to talk with you. And so I'm just so thankful to be here this morning.
This is great.
This has been a podcast powered by Uplift Appalachia. To learn more, you can find us at upliftappalachia.org or at Uplift Appalachia on Instagram.